Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast of the 4th of December 2011. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, and Phil from the West End Whingers. Okay, we're going to start by talking about Comedy Errors at the Olivier Theatre. This stars Lenny Henry in his second Shakespeare, first appearance, I believe, at the National Theatre. He plays Antipholus of Syracuse, one of two pairs of twins, one set of twins lives in Ephesus and the other set of twins come from Syracuse. They have been split, so you have the master and the servant, and their lookalikes who are also master and servant, one from Ephesus, one from Syracuse, and they get into all sorts of japes. This actually is set kind of in London. You start off with the Duke character almost being a rather vicious gangland boss, which was rather odd, because the Duke character in the play is actually quite nice in the end, and he sort of has to transform into being quite nice, and but it begins very dark and rather strangely. It also has an acted out Aegeon, who is the father of the posh twins rather than the servant twins. He relates a story to...
He's the father of both twins. That's the whole point of twins.
Well, there, yes, of course he is. but he relates a story, and it is acted out. It is acted out in a tableau. Now, what did you think of this play?
Well, I'd never seen it before, so actually I believe it's Shakespeare's shortest play, and I think, and I could be wrong, that it's not quite the opening speech, it's more or less the opening speech, where he explains this in a rather lengthy way, the story of the two pairs of twins, is acted out behind him. And if you don't know the play, I think that really helps.
That was actually really helpful. I'd actually seen an even shorter version of it, that was only 1 hour long in September, and I could not keep up, and the tableau was very, very helpful.
Yeah, and it is a very short play. I mean, I timed it. It was 2 hours, 15 minutes, including the interval, because the curtain went up 5 minutes late. So that's got me on side straight away. I think it's slightly overdone in the setting. The setting is spectacular, and it's Bunny Christie, and it's usual Bunny Christie wonderful set. It's probably at times a bit too much, because it takes quite a bit of shifting around as it constantly changes. But the changes are sort of covered by a sort of apparently Romanian singing band. I didn't know what language they were singing, but they sing sort of modern classics like Mad World, which for me, I mean, often those sort of musical interludes at the National are quite tedious between scenes to cover scene changes. But they worked for me because the songs were so great. I think release a CD, actually. They sounded fantastic.
Let's see. So I was actually almost entirely focused on, ignoring the set and stuff. What was happening with the telling of this story? Because when I'd got my previous cut down version of it, as done by Propeller for children, it was super slapstick, and a lot of the comedy, I think, in this story is about the masters beating up on the servants. And I think that's really played like it's just extraordinarily humorous to, have one of the Dromios come up to one of the Antipholuses and get, struck in the face or, punched. And I really was having a hard time getting just like the tiniest bit of comedy out of it.
Basil Fawlty used to get away with it, didn't he? And that was funny.
Who?
Basil Fawlty, John Cleese in Fawlty Towers. He used to constantly beat him. Well, I mean, it's sort of an old kind of thing. It shouldn't be funny, but those bits were quite funny, I thought.
I'm not laughing at it. I'm not finding that stuff translating very well. Some of the dialogue there's a particular piece of dialogue about a woman being as tall as she is wide, and so fat that if you put a wick into her, she'd burn after the end of the world. And that was actually, I thought, extremely funny. And, you know, a really good piece of dialogue that utterly transcended, you know, the time in which it was written.
And a joke about Belgium as well. Which is obviously quite timeless. Perhaps he invented it.
Yeah, just like, you know, jokes about corrupt governments and corrupt ministers somehow always seem to hold their humor. I found that jokes about and witnessing servants being beaten on stage was no more funny than watching a Taming of the Shrew for me. It's the 21st century, and to me this isn't funny anymore. Because I wanted Dromio to stand up and say, I'm sorry, you can't treat me like that because I'm a human being. I'm not a dog. And even a dog would leave if it was kicked that much. So I was actually having a little bit of difficulty with a lot of the comedy of this play.
Yeah, I mean, I agree to an extent about the fact that I didn't think the whole evening was very funny. It made me laugh a few times. Most of the times it did make me laugh wasn't, apart from the one where he's comparing the woman to countries of the world. I didn't find much of the text very funny, but then I don't with Shakespeare. And most of the laughs come from business, like that, or like the knife that is wielded, which is still in its wrapper, things like that. And I think that's where it succeeds most in its comedy. So it didn't really get a sort of a fast kind of pace that one apparently, you know, you can get with comedy errors. And there's a very, very frantic sort of chase scene in Act Two where, you know, all the resources are brought on. They come on in scooters, the men in white coats are running around, and then you get a full-size real ambulance driven on stage, which was, I thought, desperately unfunny.
You know, the stuff that I liked that this did very well was the visiting Antipholus and Dromio, the ones from Syracuse, are convinced that the fact that they are being recognized by all these people is a sign that they're in sort of a magical land, or perhaps they're just dreaming what's happening, which frees them up to be more outrageous than they would be if it was reality. And they keep doing things like snapping their fingers to scare away spirits. And I felt like that actually pulled me into the mindset of the Syracusans better than just listening to the text would have done. And I think it also kind of maybe pulled on perhaps the... It seemed as if they may have been from a different culture altogether than the native Syracusans were. And I thought that that kind of helped, you know, show their differences from them. Of course, Antipholus came off like the seediest, most disgusting port city in the world. Definitely a very different...
You mean Ephesus,
culture.
Yeah.
Oh, Ephesus. Yeah.
I thought that the guys from Syracuse, and all of them, including possibly Aegean, they were supposed to be sort of African, properly African.
Yeah.
Rather, I mean, certainly Lenny Henry and Lucien Samati Lenny Henry puts on an African accent, and
yeah, which I thought was Caribbean, which was a bit.
It was possible.
Oh, I'm glad it wasn't just me.
I might be wrong, of course. Yeah.
In a way, I mean, given that you you have to accept the conceit that they look so alike that their wives don't recognise them. I thought the adoption of the accent, which I could understand to give the idea that he's come from another place. You think, well, you've got different accents. Why don't you spot that? I'll accept that you're meant to look alike, but the accent, I don't know, that just for me sort of unwrapped it a little bit. really, for me, because you can sort of accept the rest of it, the look-alike thing, because they were reasonably alike, particularly the two Dromios looked quite alike with their matching wigs and Arsenal T-shirts with a nice product placement for Emirates all over them. But what about the performances? What do people think of that?
Well, I have to say I like the two women, Adriana, played by...
Yeah, they were...
And,
I think they shone it.
...played by Michelle Terry. I'm very good doing Essex girls.
Yeah.
But they were exceptionally good. I mean, it is a problem. I mean, also there was a little bit that they did, one of the jokes that they did while people were trying to get in, where Lenny Henry and the Claudie Blakely appeared in sort of with towels on, having... probably indulged themselves, and it doesn't quite ring true with him falling in love with the sister, you know.
Is that presumably that doesn't normally happen?
No. I mean, they appear at the door. They appear at the door. The whole door scene. Yeah. And this was actually quite well done, because it can be, again, there are lots of bits in this play that can be a bit tedious. But overall, this is a rather good production. Certainly I enjoyed it while I was doing it. And as you say, you're not laughing at the jokes. I mean, a lot of the time the problem with Shakespeare's jokes is he relies on puns, and there are entire scenes of Shakespeare plays which are just one pun after another, and they are tedious because we don't do puns anymore. And unless you're Tim Vine, you know Tim Vine does puns, but you don't pun after pun after pun. You get things like that in Twelfth Night, and there's a particularly execrable scene in, I think, it's Two Gentlemen of Verona, which is all pun, and it's terrible. But this, I mean, again, this, you know, there aren't. It is one of those things with we just don't get the jokes in Shakespeare anymore, which is a pity. So you do have to rely quite a lot on business, and there was a lot of this, you know, very physical. I mean, as you say, the beating is extremely physical, which is very reminiscent, as you said, of Petruchio in Taming of the Shrew, where he's extremely vicious as well, and the sort of Antipholus and Syracuse, and both Antipholuses are quite similar to Petruchio. But I think, again, that's a joke. You know, the idea of the servant being beaten is a joke that goes back ages. I mean, it's both of those, I think, are possibly of Roman sources. So it was a staple, the servant getting beaten. But I think the idea is that the servant gets their own back at some point.
You asked how the acting was, and you know, I thought it was quite competent, and I thought that I actually thought that the parents of Antipholus and Dromio,
Aegeon and Emilia.
Yeah, Joseph Mydell and
Pamela Nonviti.
She only shows up at the very end. They actually did a lot with their roles, and like at the end when the family was reunited, I actually got a little teary-eyed.
That was very well done. I mean, it's a very long scene of exposition, isn't it? It's quite like sort of an Agatha Christie day Newman, but there were some good laughs in that as well, despite the sort of the... it was quite touching, but there was also... I don't really want to give it away, but there was sort of a running gag which got huge laughs during that, which I thought was rather sweet, in fact. What about Lenny Henry? Because I liked him in this. I thought he was quite reined in, which I thought was very good. And when he was allowed to be a little bit more sort of Lenny Henry, it worked much better when he did sort of the eye rolling and the particularly towards the end when he's allowed a little bit more sort of free rein to be almost himself.
I have to say, since I've never seen this man before, because I'm not familiar with the rest of English culture, I thought he was good and enjoyable, and he was a pleasure on stage. And if he has a shtick, I wasn't feeling that happening. It was just a good actor with comedic timing, really bringing a lot of zest to the role.
And I think he's got a lot of stage presence as well.
Yeah.
And also I liked the two Dromios. I think they were very good.
They were adorable. So put upon. Tim, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, certainly Lenny Henry was very good, and also the both Dromios were rather so they were good. The one complaint I had actually was the character of Luce, played by Claire Cathcart, who is nothing like the way she's described. It has to be said, she is supposed to be as broad as she is round, and actually she's quite nice looking, you know.
Luciana.
No, Luce. Luce was the servant girl who was extremely fat.
I liked her anyway. I thought it was really fun.
But she's not supposed to be. But she's supposed to be this extremely fat person, and actually she wasn't. But yeah.
I thought that was fine, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. The bigger problem I had was that even though, like, each of the performances was fine, I just wasn't ultimately particularly engaged with this play. You know, the interval came, I went out, I got my drink, and I went back in, and I sat down and I watched the rest of it, and I walked away from it, and really, aside from, you know, my few little, you know, tears at the end of, you know, because I was being goopy, the whole thing just completely fell out of my head and was forgotten as soon as I walked away. It was just an evening's entertainment and really not particularly memorable. And I think it probably comes down to it not being a particularly strong piece of writing on Shakespeare's part.
Okay, we're now going to talk about Kitchen Sink by Tom Wells, which is a new play at the Bush Theatre. In fact, the first full play at the Bush Theatre. They did the 66 books as a sort of opener for the theatre, but this is the sort of the first main production, I suppose. What did you think of this play? And tell us more about it, Gareth.
Well, the play is what I called a blue collar play, which I think is frankly quite refreshing at the moment, because every new play you seem to see is a very middle class play. So last week, in fact, I saw two, one from the US in Reasons to Be Pretty, and this, and I think that's actually very refreshing. This is set somewhere near Hull. I've forgotten the name of the place.
Withernsea,
and we're with a family where Martin, the father, is a milkman, and he's struggling with what a lot of people are struggling in retail, is that his business is being killed by a large supermarket that will remain nameless called Tesco's, because people are no longer buying their milk from the milkman, and his metaphorically his milk float is also physically struggling as well. His daughter has lost her job in Woolies, and she's tried to become a jiu-jitsu teacher. And his son, who's gay, has just got into art college, where they've mistaken his homage to his heroine Dolly Parton, a painting with sequins, as postmodern kitsch. The mother is keeps the family together and is a lollipop lady. And the other character is Sophie's friend / boyfriend. I don't think they kind of consummate their relationship, who worked with her Woolies and is now becoming a plumber. It all sounds very dull, but it isn't dull, because it's actually, in my view, it's actually deeply perceptive, because it's bringing up a lot of what's happening to people today. You know, people are struggling to find careers and to make a way for themselves in the world, because it's changing so fast. You know, that the 16-year-old and the 18-year-old are struggling to do what, you know, in my day was much easier to do. And I from that point of view, I think the play is therefore very interesting, because it's a bit of a play of our times, but very different from what we're used to, in the sort of epic sweep of Hares and Mike Bartlett's and so on. I mean, much more on a much smaller family scale, really. And of course, it is called the Kitchen Sink. Kitchen Sink was the term coined for those plays with angst in the late 50s, early 60s. This one actually has a whole kitchen, because you sit in the round in the New Bush Theatre with the kitchen right in the middle of you, which does give the play a great intimacy, although it does lead to all sorts of problems navigating the space when you go in and out, and also in terms of sight lines, where sometimes you can't hear everybody's. So you can hear everybody's conversation. You can't see the faces of everybody who's speaking, and sometimes you really want to do that. So that's the kind of crux of it, really. It's a sort of family drama, but a little bit of a state of our times that takes place in the North in a working class family.
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that it is actually quite witty and funny. I mean, it's, you know, there's it isn't sort of Sturm and Drang. It's not, you know, it's not people sort of tearing. It's not really people tearing each other apart. I mean, obviously it's a family and they're arguing with each other, but it's not nasty. You know, it's not a sort of a nasty. It's not a hoodie drama, so to speak. And it's not about sort of massive deprivation, although they are in trouble, and yeah, you know, it could easily go that way. But it's a, I found it very warm and witty. I did have a slight problem with some of the sort of the setup ideas, you know, things that are funny but just can't really sustain. The mother's highly experimental cooking. I don't think she would do what she does on Christmas Day.
No,
it wasn't believable. The young man's the gay son's his gayness isn't a problem in the play, which is always a good thing, but the whole art school thing didn't make any sense to me, unfortunately, and it really, you know, started getting annoying at times. It's more that he wouldn't be able to pull the wool over an art school's eye with a picture of the Dolly Parton, which we initially see on a cold day, let's say on a cold day, not wearing a bra, which is why it has to be covered in sequins. And I don't think they would be taken in. And also, he doesn't understand, the young man doesn't understand what art school is all about. Now, okay, they say some rather witty and amusing things about what an art school in London is like, and they're quite possibly right about that, but it just didn't make sense that he wouldn't know. You know, the characters have access to the internet. There must be art schools in Hull, and, you know, that he would have access to and would know what was expected. And there's another thing which also is about the guy with the milk float. They're all sort of on their own, because there's no idea that the son has sort of an art teacher helping him put together his portfolio. There's no idea that the milkman is actually part of a company that has, you know, he appears to be entirely self-employed. And that didn't quite ring true, which was, you know, it's those odd jarring notes which slightly made me say that this isn't a, you know, wonderful, because it really could have been, if those things didn't jar me, this really would have been a very good piece. And other than that, it's just, you know, it is just good. I think most people aren't going to worry as much as me, and they're going to enjoy it, and they probably should.
I think maybe I'm sort of prepared to suspend disbelief a bit more than you then, because although I agree with you that the food thing was rather implausible, I thought it was a very clever way of showing how she was trying to move on while he was really trying to cling to the past. And I actually thought it perfectly plausible that some daft bloke in art school in London would see that picture as being postmodern kitsch, but I take your point. I think that, you know, you do have to suspend disbelief in this play rather more than most, but what you're rewarded with, in my opinion, is something that's very human and very charming and very warm. And you're absolutely right, it's the absolute antidote to all the kind of modern plays we see today where it's teenagers with guns and you can't understand half what they're saying, and for me, therefore, it was doubly refreshing, really, because it did have things to say, but it did it in a way that was charming and captivating and delightful. And it was a very warm evening. You know, I went with two friends, one of whom is Japanese, whose English is good but not great, and she came out saying, you know, I don't think I've seen anything this good before. So I mean, it really worked. You know, really worked for someone that couldn't identify at all with what was happening to in this part of the world and these people's lives. Really,
we'll move on now to The Lady Killers. This is an adaptation of the famous evening comedy. It is written by sitcom writer extraordinaire Graham Linehan and directed by Sean Foley. It has a wonderful cast: Peter Capaldi, James Fleet, Ben Miller, Clive Rowe, Stephen White, and Marcia Warren. It's not an exact it's not an exact remake of the film. I believe that Graham Linehan said that he basically rewrote, because he had to set the whole thing inside the house. He didn't create. He recreated all the lines, so there aren't that many lines from the play, from the film, in sort of internally, from inside the inside the house. Essentially, this is about a group of people planning a robbery of a cash delivery to a mail train, and they're going to do it near in the King's Cross area, and they find a house where they can plan. And I also decide to rope in the old lady who owns the house, and to take part in the robbery by collecting the money from the station where they've stashed it. What did you think about this play, Gareth?
Well, I mean, I saw it the night after The Kitchen Sink, and I absolutely loved it. And I'm a huge Ealing comedy fan, and I was really worried that it was going to be a film-to-stage transfer. But it actually isn't a film-to-stage transfer. What they've done is they've taken the kind of spirit of the Ealing comedies, but for me, by having Sean Foley direct it, and having Graham Linehan write it, what they've done is they brought a sort of a more contemporary, you know, a little bit of surrealism, a little bit of absurdity, a kind of cartoon-like quality to it, and lots of physical comedy. So for me, it's more of a homage to the film, and it is freshly written. I mean, as Linehan has been saying in reviews, I mean, this is a new piece of writing, and it's a freshly written piece, and I just thought it worked so, so well. And I haven't laughed so much in the theatre, other than One Man, Two Governors, at all, I think, this year, as much as this. And yet, when I wasn't laughing, I was kind of smiling all the time. And I kept wondering whether it was because I'm so attached to the film and the genre. But the friend I went with, Helen, hadn't even seen The Lady Killers, and she also absolutely adored it. So I don't think it's my kind of bias, really. I thought it was a lovely, lovely evening. And the set is a kind of higgledy-piggledy. I called it a bit Heath Robinson, really. And the set itself is great fun. And the set actually sort of performs, for want of a better word, as indeed does the kitchen sink in The Kitchen Sink. And I just found the whole evening, in a way, similarly to The Kitchen Sink, albeit, you know, clearly a very different sort of story. But, you know, in the same way, it was delightful and charming, and a very warm evening that I kind of, you know, I did leave with a warm glow, really.
I enjoyed myself quite a lot. I did find myself having problems, some slight problems with it. There were certain things that didn't quite gel about it for me. But I actually went back and watched the film, and I discovered that it's just as much the film I didn't quite get. I mean, about it. Now, they're not actually trying to be any of the characters in the film. It's very important to say that, because it's an absolutely classic Alec Guinness role. Which Peter Capaldi takes on, and he's nothing, you know, he's not really anything like the Alec Guinness role. He's taking on different parts, and everyone is a different characterization, so they're not trying to recreate the film in any way. I did find, because they couldn't do the sort of the exterior bits where you see the train line, which is nearby, which carries off everybody to Newcastle, or wherever the trains are going from King's Cross, but because you don't really see that, you don't really get that the sense of them sort of going off, and I didn't always feel that the deaths really worked. If people know the film, I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say this. I mean, we should say that this is an early preview, so I think I'm exceptionally fussy. I did laugh a lot at it, but I do think it could still sort of tighten up an awful lot. They have been doing this in Liverpool for a month, I believe, so it's they've had a lot of time to get to know each other. They're very good on the physical side of things. We should point out, for people who don't know, Sean Foley is part of the Right Size group with Hamish McCall, and they do sort of they're sort of a slightly clownish double act, doing a lot of stuff at Edinburgh Festival and one or two plays. Their most famous piece was the play What I Wrote, which they did in about 10 years ago, and it had, if you've ever seen any right size stuff, it has a bit of that way of doing things about it, and it worked extremely well. I mean, they certainly the physical aspects, as I said, work very well. It's an excellent knight, and it bears, you know, you don't worry about the comparisons with the film, really.
And I think that you're right that it does have the stamp of Sean Foley in the right size. And indeed, their big hit was, of course, also a homage to Morecambe and Wise, the play what I wrote. But it also has Lineham, who wrote Father Ted and the IT Crowd for TV. It does have his stamp on it as well, in the writing, you know, even though it's nothing like the same, obviously, but it does have that kind of feel for it, that little bit of absurdity and that little bit of surrealism, really. But it's just, you go to so many evenings in the theatre which are not, you know, which don't qualify as entertaining. It's frankly quite refreshing to go to an evening that you just come out and say, well, that was entertaining. And I don't normally do previews. I did it for this one because I knew it had run for 3 weeks in Liverpool, thinking, well, they'd have sorted things out by now. I don't think they had sorted everything out by now, but it didn't bother me, really. I just sort of felt that, the few mistakes that they made, I just took in the spirit of it all, really. But I would warmly recommend it, warmly recommend it.
Right, we're going to move on now to talking about the What's on Stage Awards. These are awards that are voted for by theatre goers, and I'm looking now at the running list of them. I'm not sure how we're going to do this, but it's really if anything jumps out at you. I think we talked. I spoke when we did when we talked on this podcast about the Evening Standard long list. I went through that at the time, and this is again a very similar list of names, really. They have slightly more people in there, slightly more people on the list than this Evening Standard long list, because they do sort of best actor, best supporting actor, and things like that. So we've got slightly more people. It looks like people are, for best actress, people are really going for Vanessa Redgrave. You've also got Eve Best, Kristen Scott Thomas, Ruth Wilson, Samantha Spira, and Tamsin Greig. Now, I would always go. I kind of like Eve Best for this because I didn't like her before I saw her in Much Ado About Nothing, and she sort of changed my mind. And also Ruth Wilson, but I think everybody else is going for Vanessa Redgrave.
Yeah, I didn't see this performance because I've seen the play before and just think it's an okay play and really don't want to go again.
That's Driving Miss Daisy, yeah.
No, Driving Miss Daisy. And quite frankly, I don't really like Vanessa Redgrave. I've just never taken to her acting style. My problem with this category is I've only seen three of the six.
Oh, right.
So I didn't see the Much Ado at the Globe that Eve Best was in, and I didn't see Kirsten Scott Thomas because of my aversion to Pinter. But of the three I did see, Tasman Gregg would have been mine, actually. I think Tasman Gregg's performance is very, very subtle in Jumpy, and she would have been mine. But, it's not fair to say she's of the three.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, she was. I mean, I think they were all good. But I can't actually. To be honest, I mean, I haven't seen Vanessa Redgrave yet, and really, none of them really jump out at me. I mean, in terms of Greig, she was good. But Greig, sorry, she's always good. She was delivering sort of her normal performance, a good performance, as were everybody else. But I'm not sure about the standouts. But how about in the best actors?
Yeah, a much better field, I think. I mean, it was, to be frank, a better year for actors than actresses, I think. And here, of course, you've got Jude Law for Anna Christie at the Don, Mark Kevin Spacey for his Richard III, which I think I enjoyed a lot more than many people did. James Corden for his play One Man, Two Governors of the National. So I think it's another Much Ado nomination for David Tennant, of course, and James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones is a great actor. I mean, I thought he was fantastic in the Tennessee Williams last year, but I've seen four of those, and from that field, I'd probably pick James Corden because I really think he held that together very well, although, as serious acting performances. You know, I loved the other three. I thought Jude Law was a revelation for me. I don't think I've seen Jude Law two or three times before, but never that good. And I do think Spacey did a good Richard III. It would be a tough one, I think.
Yeah, the another actor who's doing quite well in the sort of the rankings at the moment is Benedict Cumberbatch. This is Frankenstein, and he was part with Johnny Lee Miller, and of course got a joint award by the Evening Standard with Johnny Lee Miller for Frankenstein. His performance was very good. The thing about David Tennant and James Corden is they're kind of doing what I'd expect them to do. I mean, James Corden has a sort of almost playing himself in his role. He was very good though. And David Tennant is sort of, you know, it was what you expected. Of course, I slightly preferred Charles Edwards in the role. The Globes Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah.
Which is a slight pity.
I didn't either. I decided to give Much Ado a miss this year, really, because I've seen so much Shakespeare. I decided I didn't want to see it again, despite the casting. And I have to say, in the West End one, having Catherine Tate in it is a very good reason for not seeing it, in my opinion. But.
So you're not going to like her for the Best Supporting Actress, then?
Well, I didn't see Season's Greetings, because I also am a bit done with Akeborn at the moment as well, really. So Akeborn and Tate is a double whammy for me, I'm afraid.
Okay, I mean lots of people are voting for Catherine Tate. The other big one, of course, is Sheridan Smith for Flare Path.
But you know what's astonishing about that is this is not a supporting role. You know, they've listed it in the nomination for Best Supporting Actor in a play, or Best Supporting Actress in a play. I mean, this is a pivotal role in the play, and I just don't see how you can describe that as a supporting role. She should be up there for Best Actress, and she should win it. It's sort of, to me, that's absolutely straightforward, but there you go.
Yes, I mean, if there's justice, she ought to win it for this, but it looks like Catherine Tate is there. I noticed Bryony Hanna is in the nominations, and I did want to mention her because she is a very, very scary actress. I mean, she's good, but her performance in Children's Hour, I don't know if you saw that, was really rather fantastic. I thought. I mean, it's possibly not as the role is so nasty. It's the nasty girl who spreads all the rumours in that, and she was very good in that.
Well, I think for a young actress like that to basically, I did see it, and for her to out-act Ellen Burstyn and Keira Knightley and Elizabeth Moss tells you something. I mean, she absolutely carried that revival of the play, and I thought she was terrific. But if I had to choose in that category, I'm afraid it would be Sheridan Smith. As I said, the only one I haven't seen there is Catherine Tate. But I could never, you could never put Dune McKeachin in the same category, in the same level of quality there as either Sheridan Smith or Bryony Hanna for me. That was nothing like as good. The double nomination thing is interesting because I think the Evening Standard frankly got it right by nominating those two. I think it would have been to give the award to those two. It would have been invidious, I think, to give to one or the other. And here to have one nomination, I think, is a bit of a shame, really. The Olivier Awards did that in my day, because I was on the Olivier Awards panel once, and we wanted to give the Best Supporting Actor in a Musical role for Kiss Me, Kate to both Emil Walk and John Barton. And they said, well, we can't because it's an extra statuette. But we basically sat around the room and said, we're not leaving this room until you agree. So that was the beginning of the time when you were allowed to have two people winning the same role. Well, I won't tell you how long ago it was, but it was a long time ago.
I'm a little bit worried about having to go through all of these. Are there any other that really stand out for you in terms of musicals? I mean, are there any sort of people up for awards that we're looking at?
I haven't seen Matilda yet, so clearly, you know, I'm missing something big, and I'm seeing it on Friday. I was hugely disappointed that Landor's Hired Man wasn't nominated for Best Musical Revival, even though their Ragtime was. And I think the Musical Revival is the toughest call, having seen all of those. I think it's the toughest call, but I think that if there's any justice, the fringe ones, you know, Things They Want, They Used to Be, Parade or Ragtime would probably take it. I think that the Best New Musical, I was a bit surprised that the 25th Putnam Spelling Bee, whatever it's called, wasn't there, and a bit disappointed that Roadshow wasn't there, because I thought Roadshow was a lot better than a lot of people thought. And in the plays, I mean, I was, again, surprised that the the two that bookended the Almeidas not such great year, the Becky Shore and Reason to Be Pretty weren't there. And I don't know where you'd put it, but I'm disappointed, even though it's closing, the Backbeat doesn't figure somewhere, because I thought Backbeat, probably as a play, was very good too.
Oh yeah, Backbeat is here somewhere. I didn't notice it. Yes, I'm trying to find it, but
it's probably best lighting design or something really crucial, I would imagine.
Yes.
Can I just say something about these awards? Because, you know, I do like what's on stage, and I go to their outings and I put reviews on their website. But the problem with these awards is that the winners, not the nominees, because I think it's easier to get nominated than to win. But the to win, you have to have a big fan base, which means that if you take Ragtime at the
Landor.
Ragtime was seen by as many people who would see Ghost on a Saturday night in its entire run. And I just, you know, it just isn't in for a chance, I don't think, really, which is a great shame. And I don't know how you can do this, but I got into a Twitter spat last year because after the awards were announced and Jonathan Groff from Glee had won the Best Supporting Actor for Death Trap, which I thought was deadly dull, but an okay performance, I put something on Twitter and I was getting inundated by little girls from Moose Droppings, Iowa, you know, who were telling me that he was brilliant and wonderful and how horrible I was. And then it dawned on me, the reason Jonathan Groff had won is because he had a big fan base. And, you know, the young black actor in the Royal Court, who was stunning in Sucker Punch, couldn't get a look in that circumstance. And at the end of one of the spats with one of these young girls, it was clear that they hadn't seen the play, because she actually sort of said, well, if I ever came to London, I'd go and see it. And yet she'd been voting for this. And that, to me, sort of said, well, hang on a minute. You know, there is a flaw here in internet-based voting, isn't there? You know, you can't stop that thing from happening, and I understand that. But to me, that completely discredited that award. And that's the one thing that bothers me. I think awards, you know, awards will go because they have a fan base, because lots of people will vote them. I'm already being inundated with tweets from theatres and actors and whatever saying, vote for my play, almost as if it doesn't matter whether I've seen it or not. And I think that's, you know, a bit of a problem I have with the whole awards thing, even though I actually like the principle of the sort of democratization of awards. I still think at the end of the day, frankly, that the Olivier's and the Evening Standard tend to get more right, despite that. But there you go.
Yeah, I will just point out that Backbeat and the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee are both nominated in the Best Ensemble Performance category.
Oh, okay.
Although that's likely to go to London Road, unfortunately.
Yes, I mean, London Road, again, I think is nominated for Best Musical, but for me it's not a musical, it's a play with music. And as much as I loved it and went to see it twice, I couldn't call it a Best New Musical. You know, based on what I've seen, Betty Blue Eyes would be a steal, but I suspect that next week I might be saying Matilda. But you have to wait until March or something to find out. The voting time goes on absolutely. It is longer than the American election, this voting system.
You can follow the podcast at AYULTP on Twitter, the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast page on Facebook, on the web at ayu-londontheatre.org. We can also be found by searching for the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you and goodbye.